Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Everybody loves the word resilience, but the truth is most people do not find out what they're made of when life is easy. They find out when life hits hard, when plans fall apart, when identity is shaken, and when they have to decide whether they're going to stay down or rebuild. Today's guest is Dr. Scott Aris. He has an amazing story. His story is one of those stories that you instantly makes you rethink what's possible. He lost his left leg in a motorcycle accident, and he returned to full active duty in just 10 months. He served 2 combat tours, went to earn a PhD, and became a professor, and built ACE Consultant into a Inc. 5000 recognized company, grounded in service, urgency, and doing with the right thing. But this conversation is much bigger than that. It's one man's story. It's about adversity, and it can teach us all about leadership, innovation, discipline, and how to build life with purpose after everything changes. The real problem is what happens when life changes overnight. Now, I admire everything that you went through, Scott, and I just want to like get right into it, because this is such an exciting topic for me, because, you know, so many people get stuck in life and they need to know how to get past that and build that resilience within them. So let's start with the moment that life changed everything, when everything changed for you. A lot of people that are listening to this have been hit by something that they didn't plan for. Maybe it was a loss, a health issue, a business setback, or a moment that completely disrupted their life. They thought that they were building. You lost your left leg in a motorcycle accident. And instead of letting that define you and make it the end of the story, you made a decision to rebuild. Can you tell us a little about that and the story behind it?
Absolutely. I thought you were going to ask me for a story on resilience. And I was writing on my notepad here and I was like, which one? Difficult situations in my life. It's good being here with you today, Stacey. I just, in 2002, I had just been promoted to Chief Petty Officer in the United States Navy. I was a CB, basically we do construction, and me and my wife were going out to dinner to celebrate my promotion, and I happened to, I was riding my motorcycle, she was taking my kids in her car. I got off on an exit, was going down a 2-lane road, and a lady came across the center line. You know, she had the sun in her face and was talking on a cell phone, and she ran into me head on. I swerved to miss her, and my foot was on the peg of the motorcycle. It crushed the driver's side bumper of her car, and basically it threw me off the bike because she was doing 40. I was doing 40. I laid there dying, essentially, and happened that God sent somebody to me. He actually sent somebody who was formerly an Army paramedic, and she prevented me from bleeding to death because she tried a tourniquet around my leg. Got in the ambulance. I don't remember much. And then my wife, I remember waking up and I was in the emergency room, and my wife says, "Hey, they want to take your leg. It's just a bag of bones at this point. Are you okay with that?" You know? So I said, absolutely, do whatever you got to do to keep me in the Navy. Because, I mean, the Navy was everything to me at that point in time. And, it was a matter of being able to pay, earn a living for my family, you know? And so, you know, we had 3 little kids. They're all under the age of 5. So, anyhow, so I lost my, they took my foot that night. They took my leg halfway up. A couple days later, I had a total reconstructive knee surgery and my femur had broken into three pieces. So they had to piece that back together. So it was actually compound femur fracture. And so I spent the next, I spent the next 3 weeks recovering from those surgeries, and I went back for additional surgeries, spent the next 2 months recovering from those surgeries, went through another series of surgeries. And so that happened in February of 2002. So I was running, starting to run on my prosthetic the end of April. It was about nine weeks. And so after they had cut my leg back open and gone through all that trauma, so then I spent the next, you know, period of time recovering for the Navy, and the Navy didn't make it easy. They wanted to retire me. I didn't want to get retired. So I just, I chose to fight them. And so I was losing. And then one day, and this is really interesting, one day I happened to be in Mississippi. That's where I was stationed. And I heard that Senator Lott was coming through. He was the, you know, a senator, a GOP senator from Mississippi. He was also the Senate head, you know, the chair of the Senate. And so I thought, maybe this is my opportunity to get something in front of him. So I wrote him a letter, put it in an envelope, went to his, this, they were commissioning some housing there. And I walked up to one of his aides and said, I would like you to give this to Senator Lott. And he goes, "What?" And they said, okay. The next day, I got a phone call from Senator Lott's office asking, okay, we want to help you. What can we do? And at that point, I had passed everything. I had ran the mile and a half. I push-ups, sit-ups, also requalified with everything I'd done from, you know, driving a stick tractor trailer, you know, where I'd get to use my prosthetic to rappelling, you know, for disaster recovery. So I was just waiting for the Navy to say something. Well, the Navy, all the way to the only person who approved me saying the Navy was my commanding officer. Everybody else in the chain of command, all the way to the chief of naval operations, disapproved me. So Senator Lott called me back and said, here's how we can help. We're going to do a congressional inquiry on you. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the Navy saw that, obviously the Navy wasn't happy. So, they basically about literally an hour later, I got a phone call from a medical doctor that said, hey, I was appointed by the Navy to review your case, and I may have to call you, ask for questions. Put down the phone, literally 30, 45 minutes later, he called me back and says, well, congratulations, you're back to active duty. So, so the funny thing is that when I went up for orders, that tells you where you're going to go next. They decided to send me to Iraq during the Iraqi and Afghanistan war. So I always tell my kids, beware what you wish for, because you may very well get it, you know? So I spent three more years there, and then I retired from the Navy.
Wow. You know, I'm so surprised that they actually were able to keep you in the Navy, because you always hear stories when people get hurt, you know, they're unable to serve anymore, you know, as unfair as that is, you hear that all the time, you know, an accident occurred or they were injured in duty and, you know, they end up having to retire, and you were able to beat that and you were able to get the help you needed so you could stay in the Navy. You had a goal and you were determined to, you know, to make sure it happened.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is, I tell people when I talk about it, is when you go through a difficult situation, like I had to go through, it really defines who you are, because who you really were, it comes out. And I was always, you know, on top of things, and I was always trying to be the best at everything that I did. And that played in exactly to when those situations occurred, you know? So, resilience is a very important word. And, for me, it was just a matter of this is not a really big deal. Because for me, what choice did I have? Lay in a hospital bed for the rest of my life? Right. Be on crutches for the rest of my life? Get out of the Navy and, you know, take the little retirement and, you know, and live the rest of my life? And I wasn't satisfied with that. So that's why I pursued something bigger that may have been impossible, because at the time it did look impossible.
Wow. You know, what did that experience teach you about what people get wrong about adversity?
Now, that's a great question. And when it, people think it, people, most people want to quit when it gets really tough, you know?
Yeah.
But I always say, and we're currently going through this, my wife came down with breast cancer twice, and we're going through the second, in fact, I'm taking her to radiation today. We're going through the second round of her having breast cancer, 10 years separated the two. And somebody asked me the other day, so how's it going? And I said, and this plays into what happened with me. And I said, when it looks the darkest, it's almost over. So, and so that, and it's so true. When it looks really, really tough, it really is almost over, and you just have to pursue through that and continue to, you know, do everything that you can do with what God's given you, you know? The other thing is I'd have to say is worry. We always worry. But it's a waste of time because 90% of what we worry about never happens. So the best thing, you know, I tell people all the time, the best thing you can do when you worry is write down the outcomes. Right. And if the outcomes, you know, at least you know what they are, you know?
Yeah.
So rather than just thinking, well, this can happen and that can happen. So we always go worst case. We never go best case. So it's important to kind of keep that in mind. When it gets dark, you're almost through. And so I can say that for me. My darkest point was when I was addicted to prescription pain medication. You know, I had lost my leg. I had gone through all the pain, gone through, you know, 7 different surgeries. And then on the other side of that, you think, oh my gosh, you know, going through withdrawal from prescription narcotics.
Yeah.
Is this ever going to get better? And I asked myself that question 100 different times, but God always came through, you know, so I just keep that in mind.
That's a great way of looking at it when you said when it's dark, you're almost through it, because usually people don't look at it from that perspective. Usually people see when it gets dark, they give up, you know, and they kind of fall apart, or they just get stuck and they kind of hide in a hole, you know, because it's just, they don't know what to do next. That resilience, you know, is lacking at that point, because there's so many, they're overwhelmed with, you know, emotional, you know, feelings that they just kind of crumble up. But, you know, when you look at it that way, when it's the darkest, it's almost over. That's kind of powerful. That's really, you know, emotionally powerful, because when you think of it that way, that gives you strength just in itself.
Absolutely. And I'd have to say, and like most, you know, most people who deal with any kind of addiction, which I dealt with, I always tell people all the time, you know, I'm a recovering, you know, and I say that because when you recover from something, regardless how many years it's been, I mean, I haven't touched OxyContin in 20 years, you know?
Yeah.
So, but you never lose that. And, if you want something to beat you down, addiction will be the thing that beats you down. I tell everybody, I would have rather lost my leg again than to go through the prescription addiction withdrawal. So after being on narcotics for 8 months, it was really, really tough. So the part of that was having a higher purpose, you know? And my higher purpose, was, number one, was God left me here. There must be something left to do. That was the first thing. And the second thing I said was, if I lay down now and I had little kids, that's what my kids will remember.
Yes.
So it's just, you know, that pushed me and my wife for that matter. So for me, it was a matter of earning their respect through those challenges.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. Was there a point where you realized that the real battle was not just physical, but mental and identity based?
I tell people that's the worst part of it, is because, you know, especially as a man, because you associate yourself with your job, you know, or, you know, anybody's career driven associated with job. And when that's taken from you, I mean, that's worse than any kind of physical ailment you could possibly have, because it plays in your head 24/7. And I'm a worrier, you know, I've always had anxiety. I'm worried. People crack up. They're like, well, why are you worried? You don't mind taking risk. And then I was like, well, yeah, but that doesn't tell you what's inside. So what's inside is the fear and all the stuff. I'm just good at keeping it inside. And I'm also, you know, it's kind of like when you jump off a building or you rappel or you do something scary, you have to make a decision. Yeah. You know, my kids, we go boating every year. My kids jump from cliffs, you know, and when you make that commitment, you know, I mean, there's only one choice, is take the step. So it's, yeah, you know, when you make the commitment to walk up there, you just gotta take the step and put your fear aside. You know, I seen the Marine Corps once had a right. shirt that a Marine Corps recruiter gave me that said, what did it say? It said fear is the only thing that holds you back. And I thought to myself, there you go. It's right there. Most people are controlled by fear. And if you decide you're not going to be controlled by fear, and that's never been an issue for me. If I do something scary to me, I will just do it. Because, and I'm not saying stupid. There's a difference between stupid and crazy. Stupid, crazy, and, you know, but if there's something that I gotta do, I can push myself through that, because I know regardless of what happens, you know, for me, I'm going to heaven, and regardless of what happens, I've lived a good life, and I've lived a good legacy for my family. I hate to use the word legacy, because that tends to think I'm somebody important, because I'm not, you know, but you know, I'm one of these guys that sit in my office and don't really look for pats on the back. And I've never been very good at taking congratulations or anything like that. So.
You're humble.
Well, that's what my leader said, and that's Jesus Christ, the most humble guy in the world. I was watching that show, The Choice. Have you seen it? Or not, is it The Choice? It's a Rejoice. Or The Chosen. That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that was, it's really, really powerful, because context is so important.
Yes. That's so true. What do what do people need to understand about the difference between feeling defeated and actually being defeated?
Well, I would say, feeling defeated and actually being defeated happen at two separate times. feeling like you're defeated always comes before you're actually defeated. So that's why I talk about, you know, walking through the tunnel and seeing the light at the end and realizing I'm not that far. And anybody who's run or done anything physically challenging, you know what it is. It's one foot and step in front of the other. And I mean, that's kind of funny, because I lost my leg, but it's the truth. It's about putting one foot in front of the other and pushing yourself through the pain and the difficulties, because they're going to come. It's not like you have a difficult situation. I mean, it's not like something like this happens and everything's going to be hunky dory. I mean, you got to prepare yourself to go to battle. And you also got to realize that it's, when you're ready to move past that, or when you're able, you're probably at your most humble state. That's humble. And when I say humble, it's you respect the situation. You respect what has happened. And you generate humility from that.
Right. Now, one of the reasons your story is so compelling is because you didn't stop at survival. You returned to active duty, you served combat tours, and then later you earned a PhD, you became a professor, and you built a high-level company. That's not just resilience, that's renovation at its highest level. You know, when someone's life has been disrupted, how do they begin rebuilding without getting trapped in self-pity, fear, or excuses?
Well, you know, you mentioned something that I talk all the time when I talk to young people, and I say young people because now I'm old people, but the concept of paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. So my life has been filled with nothing but paradigm breaking. A lot of people don't know the long history behind it, but it started growing up poor. It went from growing, and my parents did a good job of trying to provide for us. But, you know, it was during the 80s, and, you know, tough times were tough. And my dad came to this country with nothing. He owned a janitorial business. My mom worked with him, so they were worked every night. So we were poor, but they always made sure that we were always fed and had the basic essentials. And however, coming out of poverty, you don't have the kind of opportunities other people have. And my best friend was actually the grandson of the former governor of New Mexico. And so seeing his life was really tough for me because I had a lot of envy for where he was and the opportunities I had. However, I decided that wasn't going to be me. So because of a situation, I had to drop out of high school, a family situation, I had to drop out of high school. And so, I joined the Navy, went to boot camp. It was funny when people talk about, like, what are some of the paradigms that you've broken in my life? Well, I'm a high school dropout, and I have 5 college degrees, one of them being a PhD. I came from nothing, and we have a company with 223 people currently. I started with me. You know, and is able to grow. But the whole point about excuses is important. It's easy to do nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy to you know, be tied up in self-pity, because I have done that. I'm not sitting here telling you, hey, I've never gone through self-pity. I never lacked resilience. I've never, you know, not had a paradigm that I didn't break, or, you know, I never gave excuses. I did that just like anybody else. The truth is that what I say didn't affect what I do. And so I guess that's probably the most powerful thing, is we're going to have doubts. You just got to push through things with some type of belief, either in a higher power or yourself or somebody else for them.
Right. Oh, that's so powerful. That's such an important message right now, because so many people are waiting for confidence before they move. But usually confidence comes after the movement, not before it. You know, what did discipline action look like for you in the earliest stages of rebuilding?
Well, it's going down. When someone doesn't tell you to do something, you have to develop that habit, develop that, you know, that muscle memory. That's what I call it. You know, like, you know, I would get up in the evenings and jog, you know. It became, that's when I took a nap in the afternoon. That's when I woke up, and that's just, you know, what I do. And I didn't think of it as an option. Also, you know, I'm big into writing stuff down, and I know people talk all the time that you're more likely to, achieve success if you write it down. That's totally true. Every year I put, you know, goals down. You never stop having goals. I once heard the best CEO is a CEO who can, and they did a survey, is a CEO who continues to learn. And you ask yourself, there's a group of people that highly successful people they've already done the things that they need to do. They went to school, they learned a trade, they learned about leadership, but they still read, they're still actively engaged. And so it's never order, and excuses just compromise that completely. There really is nothing. There isn't really nothing impossible when you break it down into simple, easy daily task. And that's where I think people miss it. Like I said, hey, I want to return back to the Navy. Well, that's great. But what does that look like? What are the steps to get there? And so once again, taking that anxiety, writing it down and putting it into an executable plan.
Right. Well, that's great advice. Yeah. And we're in a moment where leadership matters more than ever. You know, people are navigating uncertainty, rapid change, and a lot of pressure. Like the best leadership voices right now are talking less about control and more about adaptability, trust, and clarity. Now, you've been led in the military, in education, and business. What does adversity teach leaders that success alone never can?
Well, adaptability is the key word there, right? The ability to we call it in the military contingency action, right? And we call it that in business too, you know. But it's having a plan of what you're gonna do, you know. The best way to be adaptable is anticipating the things that are gonna go wrong, you know. And I talk about that with all my people all the time, is about anticipating, looking at preliminary indicators, not just lagging indicators, and being ready to, because when you're prepared for something going wrong, you're like, okay, we prepared for this. This is what we do. You know, like a fire on a ship in the Navy, they train you that if there's a fire, you're part of this fire team. This is what you do. And we run through drills, because muscle memory. And so when it happens, and you know, we're there to make it occur. Navy SEALs, reason they're the best in the world is because they have muscle memory. They do it every single day. And they practice.
That's so true. Now, how do you lead people when the environment is uncertain and you don't have all the answers?
And I was just talking to my management team about this. When there's uncertainty, the best thing you can do is be honest. You don't need to make a conclusion or falsely tell people, hey, this is what's going to happen. So I'm always in uncertainty. I always try to be this key word, and that's try to be authentic. I am who I am. And I guess that's what a lot of people say when they get old. But the truth is that I am who I am. There's some things that I can change, but there's a lot of things I can't.
Right.
So, you know, being authentic with people, and this is who I am, people respect that. You know, people understand that. But uncertainty is opportunity. And that's what, every time this happens, I always go back to, you know, the whole concept that when there's uncertainty, there's a hidden opportunity there. And I go back to a story real quick of when COVID happened. Everybody knows when COVID happened. They put on the news, they were closing down and everybody's working remotely. And I got my management team together on Teams, and we, first of all, we prayed and we asked for guidance. Secondly, we said, okay, this is what we're going to try to do. And every day we changed or did something different. We probably tried 100 different things. But ultimately, we were able to be successful because we pivoted from one position to another. And here's a great example. One of the things that was in need were people that could occupy job sites, when the management crew went away. Or, you know, here's the other one, is a COVID rep. We had to have someone come in and check everybody's temperature. And because we do construction staffing, the management staffing, along with scheduling and other services. That opened an opportunity that didn't exist and doesn't exist today. But if you're not willing to adapt and move, and that's what we were looking. We were looking for, okay, if this is down, what else is up?
Right.
So, I love uncertainty, and I hate to say that, but I love uncertainty because that's where my company and myself excel, because I just prepare. Preparation, preparation, preparation. Dana Perino, which is the former Bush's former, I guess, representative, she says all the time she wants to be the most read in every single room. And I thought to myself, that's 100% true. If you're the most read, information is power, you will be successful.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Now, what builds trust in a team during hard times?
Well, what I mentioned before is probably the one leadership trait I believe is the most important, is just being authentically who you are, you know, and then more importantly, surrounding yourself with people who have strengths where you're weak, you know. Yeah. One of the things I'm weak. I'm very direct and very aggressive about how I go about things. Well, I just moved to the chairman of the company, the chairman of the board. So my new CEO, which I've worked with him for the last 16 years, he's a very different person than I am. But that's what you have to have, is have to have that little bit. So he slows me down, and I don't mean in a bad way. He slows me down in a good way, because he makes me think. He knows that if I take something to him, you know, I'm looking for guidance on maybe slowing down a little bit or whatever. And having those people in your life is extremely important. And we have the next CEO after him preparing, the CEO, you know, in training. He's like me.
Yeah.
So, and then his partner is just like Matt, which is my CEO. So you have to be deliberate. You have to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And that's the key, intentionality.
Right. Now, a lot of people want, you know, transformation, but they don't want the structure that creates it. You talk about, you know, perseverance, leadership, and belief in yourself. But I want to get practical here. Where does discipline fit into the comeback story?
Well, that's tough when you're laying in bed and you have a whole bunch of pain, and you don't want to get up, and, you know, drugs don't make you exactly happy to get up and do stuff. Yeah. But I never looked at something as I have the option to do. I always looked at something as I have to do. So as I said before, I have a hard time understanding why people make a big deal about this, because I was just doing what I had to do. You know, I just got up every day because I had three kids, you know, three babies, had my wife who worked and took care of the kids. What am I going to do? Am I just going to lay down and do nothing?
Right.
My kids got to eat. You know? Yeah. I also, and as I mentioned before, people look to me. You know, my older brother, which was also in the Navy, after my accident, he came and stayed in the hospital with me, which I greatly appreciate. So if he's listening, I'm going to greatly appreciate that. But, you know, he said something right after I lost my leg that I really thought was impactful. He said, Scott, they couldn't keep up with you before, and they're going to have a difficult time now, because who you are is put on display. You can't hide being Scott anymore. You're the guy who lost a leg. You're the guy who dropped out of high school and went and got a PhD. You're the guy that started a company from nothing. And, you know, and we've grown into this massive monstrosity of a business. Yeah. And that's just, discipline is essential, really, really essential. But it starts with being intentional, writing it down. you know, on my calendar, I have every morning, I have everything I do. You know, if I need to review my iPhone apps to make sure I'm up to date on everything, that's in my schedule, you know? So it's about that intentionality.
I love that. Now, for someone who is listening right now, who feels overwhelmed or discouraged or scattered, what is one discipline that they can start immediately that begins to change their whole trajectory?
Well, congratulations. We all feel overwhelmed. That's the first one. That's the first lesson, is because you're not alone. That's an important thing to remember. People have gone through this before and you're not alone. So, you know, for me, when I lost my leg, I looked at other people who were able to return. You return, and, you know, Navy didn't, you know, have too many people. So I looked at their stories, did their research on their stories. I have to say, when I feel overwhelmed, I stop and I pray. And the reason I stop and I pray is because realizing that I'm not that important, mm-hmm. and that the ability for me to have control in this crazy world is next to nil.
Right.
You know, and I just turned that over. For me, is I just turned that over to God for me. And people ask me, you know, you'll see the Christian fish on the part of my logo. And that's because, and we're a Christian organization, we give 10% of all of our profits. I was also going to tell you, I didn't mention during COVID, my team came back because I asked them, spend the night, decide, give me some options of what we should do. Right. Because any good leader listens to all his resources.
Yes.
So they came back and every one of them provided an option, like, you know, cut this, you know, do something different, all those things. And one thing that people missed was we tithe as a company. And for me, my faith is very, very important. So the 10% that we gave, you know, I just prayed and I just told and I told the team, and it was on my heart. I just told the team, you know what? We give 10% normally, but this year we're going to give 15% because we're putting it in God's hands.
Right.
And yeah. Everyone thought I was crazy, but we grew 20%. So, and you can say, well, is that due to your duty? You are praying? Listen, I don't know, but I would come to believe that it's bigger than just me. When people are struggling and dying on the vine, we're sitting here excelling. So you can't say it's just because of me, you know? So there's got to be something more. I mean, obviously it has to do with our people and a lot of different things, but it's kind of like when Michael Jordan scored 68 points and they interviewed one of his players that came off the bench late, and they were just trying to get everybody, and he scored 2 points, and he said, well, Jordan and I won the game. And I feel like that sometimes. I feel like, well, you know, God scored the 68. I scored 2. You know, it's tough for me to take credit like that. But welcome to the club if you feel overwhelmed. We all do. Best thing you can do is quell that overwhelming feeling by stopping, thinking, concentrating, and put your faith in the fact that you're not alone.
Right. Oh, so true. So true. Now, how do, you know, you keep going on when days and motivation are completely gone?
Well, you know, my kids are grown. I'm fortunate enough to have most of the things I want, you know? And so you get to that point where you're like, okay, well, what's next? So what are you going to do next? And, you know, and I just think love God, love people. So that's what I do every single day. And I don't know if that really answered your question. That's really where I put my, so I try to be good to people. I try to be more than fair. If anybody who knows me, they'll say that and I don't, I say this humbly, but me and my wife are very, very giving people. We believe in, you know, picking people up and giving them a fishing rod so that they can move in the future and catch fish and not just the fish. Because yeah. I'm a firm believer in that. I want to give somebody the tool that they can use to be successful. So
right. Oh, I love that. One of the most powerful parts of your story is that your path didn't just come about, you know, through personal success. It came about service through business, teaching, writing, and helping others find confidence and direction. You know, that's important because a lot of people today are not just asking, how do I succeed? They're asking, how do I matter? You know, how do I do something meaningful with, you know, with what I've been through? You know, how has service shaped the way you lead and the way you live?
Well, anybody's ever read the book, A Purpose-Driven Life? It has a literary hook with, you know, people who don't, I've written 3 books and I learned a lot about writing. A literary hook is when somebody reads the first line of your book and wants to read the rest of your book, right? So you want to say something impactful, that first one. And Rick Warren said this, his very first line of his book, he said, it's not about you. 3 little words. And when you think about it like that, when you think that way, selfishness, greed, all the bad things that people do really come out, really go away. And people say, well, if you're so humble to think, hey, you know, first of all, I'm not that humble. And secondly is that it's not about you. Then what is it about?
Yeah.
And, you know, I always tell people to put your faith in something that's infallible, because everything will disappoint you, whether it's your relationship. I've been married 30 years, and whether it's your relationship with your wife, or your husband, nothing is permanent. You know, money comes and goes. Things can be taken away from you. So you have to find your foundation on something that's infallible, you know? And for me, it's my faith, you know? And everything springs from that. And, I always tell people, I'm not that great a person. I just am very, very faithful to God. And I try to be faithful to God, I should say. And I told my mother-in-law the other day, I'm okay with being an ignorant nobody. So, and that's kind of the truth, you know. I just, you know, I want to help the people I can impact and be involved in my community and with the people I'm able to touch. And I don't really waste a lot of time with other stuff.
I love that. Do you think one of the fastest ways to get unstuck is to stop obsessing over yourself and just start asking, where can you contribute?
Absolutely. That's a tough one, you know, because having it not about you is just so, so important. I've written 3 books, well, actually 4 books. And then, because one just came out, and my first book I wrote, it was titled "Pick Up Your Mat and Walk," and it had a subtitle "Success Through Adversity," and really, there are any. And by the way, I'm not trying to sell a book here, but I give 8 points in the end. It's really not a book about me, although my story is told in that book. I kind of give you an 8 point plan of things that you need to do, you know, and that goes beyond obviously our time here today, but, you know, I would highly encourage you to whoever is listening to this to pick up that book and read it. My second book is called, The Formula for Success. And there's a formula. And it's really simple. It looks a little different for each of us, but there is a formula out there. You know, 7 Habits of Successful People didn't sell millions upon millions of books just because people are not interested in being successful.
Right.
You know, I always tell people, buy my book. It's $25 paperback.
I love that. I think, you know, this is where the conversation really becomes incredibly useful for the audience, because a setback can either become a story that you hide behind or, you know, or a strategy you build from. You know, what are the practical steps, you know, for turning challenges into opportunities?
First thing I said about, you know, driving out the uncertainty as best as possible.
Right.
Understanding what you're dealing with, and probably the first one that's having, I guess the best way to say it is having clarity on the adversity.
Right.
Once you have clarity on the adversity, is take that and say, okay. Like I remember when I wanted to earn my PhD. Okay, what does that entail? So I looked it up, got a plan of all the courses, laid it out over a period of time. Put in my schedule to have a certain amount of study time every single day. And by going through those steps, you take a big concept and you break it into little chunks that you can, you know, that's how I, you know, like we always tell our kids, you know, you can't eat the entire stack or the entire chicken. You got to chop it up and eat it by little bites, because a little accomplishment today means a lot of accomplishment when you multiply it by 500. And that's really it. I mean, we have 365 opportunities every year. I mean, think about that. We have 360 times you can go to the gym. 360 times, you know, you can study. I mean, I can go on and on about it, but those daily things are really the difference maker. Adversity presents opportunity, and it's a matter of taking that opportunity and breaking it into pieces that are manageable. I won't say easy, because nothing's easy, but right. You don't need to go into gym today and you know, jog 3 miles. You can start with a 10-minute walk.
Right.
And I think that's where people overcommit from the beginning. You know, every January, everybody, the gyms are filled up. And the reason gyms are filled up is because everyone thinks I'm going to lose weight. And they go at it hard, really, really hard to begin with, and they can't maintain that momentum.
Yeah.
Harvard says is 27 days you develop a habit doing something 27 days in a row. Mm-hmm. True. If you don't believe it, your body gets used to it. And that's just, you know, when there's time naturally. I mean, when you have to get up in the morning, I'm sure that we've had all this, is sometimes you wake up and you don't need an alarm clock.
Right.
Because your body just knows. So that muscle memory.
Mm-hmm. That's true. What
I just say, the mental memory, you know,
it's true. Go ahead. It's when you do things consistently, you know, I find myself automatically doing it without even to need to remind myself that. Even like you said, with sleeping, you know, if you're on a pattern and you keep doing things over and over and over again, you'll automatically be your own alarm clock and you'll wake up naturally. It just happens.
Absolutely.
What do high performers do differently when they hit, you know, when life hits them really hard?
First off, obviously, don't quit, you know, but it's having a mentality that regardless of what it is you're going to do everything in your power, and having a realization that you can't control the outcome.
Yeah.
But you surely can control what you do.
Yeah.
And your odds are greatly increased if you do what I just said, breaking everything down to reasonable level. But I think it goes more than that. It's about, being responsive, being absolutely committed. That's probably what most people say is, you know, you're very committed. And I don't really look at it that way. It's just a mentality that, and you can see it in people. you know, one of the reasons we run a staffing company, because I was recruiter of the year when I was in the Navy. And then I also, you know, we had very successful staffing companies as it started with, it's still there. You know, we have tons of people in the field, about 180 ish in the field right now. But you can cite a high performer. It's actually pretty simple. You got to ask them questions like, and forgive me, this is more important than being a high performer, is the ability to identify a high performer. Because if you do that, you can see what you need to do. And so I have, when I do interviews, I have a list of questions that I give. And and one of them is, I remember it says, are you unoffendable? You know, and that's important because you need to not use that as an excuse. Right. I think if you're offendable, that's your excuse. I asked them in a speed round, you know, what do you, here's the questions. I got my speed round is this. I always end this in interview with this. I always say, choose one. Because you can tell a lot about how people are. And I said, dog or cat, blue or red, ocean or mountain, cars or trucks, country or rap, chicken or egg. You know, by doing those things, you know, you get an idea for where this person is at. And what I see is that if someone really anguishes over the answer and is not more aggressive about it, probably depending on the position, probably not the most aggressive person. I need to be much more. Also, in the Navy, we always called about a DBM. A DBM stands for the dominant buying motive. So what's the reason that people do what they do?
Right.
It's different for me than it is for you, you know? Right. But everybody's definition of success is different. It's kind of like the difference between rich and wealthy. Rich means you have a lot of things, money, cars, houses, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Wealthy means that you are grateful for what you have, mm-hmm. but you're satisfied in a way where it doesn't take away your motivation. And right. I should say you're content to a point. When people use the word content, sometimes people think, well, if you're content, that's a bad thing. No, it's not. You know, contentment can be a very, very positive thing. That doesn't mean stay where you're at, right. but it's an appreciation for what you have.
Right. I like that. Now, what mindset shift changes everything?
That I'm not all that good. That I may not feel like I need to be in the room. You know, have a little inferiority complex, because a lot of times I sit in a room with people. One of the guys who became a friend of mine, he went to Notre Dame, has a master's degree from Notre Dame. And not to downgrade my degree, but I didn't go to Notre Dame and I didn't go to Ivy League school. I went to a good school, but not an Ivy League school. Understanding that once you talk to them and you break down that barrier, you realize, gosh, this person is no smarter, you know, better looking, you know, more savvy, no better. You know, when I became Recruiter of the Year, I remember I walked with the previous Recruiter of the Year down the street, and he was talking on MSU's Michigan State University's campus. And when we were walking, he stopped a few people. He's talking to them. And as I was listening to him, I realized I'm not that far off.
Right.
And once again, engaging, being intentional. Intentionality is everything. Everything you do. You want to lose weight? Be intentional. Go to the gym. Watch what you eat. And it's more just going to the gym. It's also realizing that probably 82% of, you know, your ability to be healthy has nothing to do with what you do. It has to do with what you put in your body, you know? So eating, because my older son was a bodybuilder, and he's like, the hardest thing wasn't working out. It was learning to eat rice cakes.
Oh, that's funny. You know, there are people listening right now, especially leaders, men, veterans, and high responsibility individuals who have been conditioned to stay strong and keep moving and never show weakness. What do those people need to hear?
Well, one of my executives, which is a very, very smart man, he came to our company after working for a construction organization for about 15 years. A very, very smart man. Good man, too. Good Christian man. Has a really good family. I really respect him a lot as a person. And Joey, you listen to it. I'm talking about you. So, but one thing that has helped me, and the reason I have been able to be successful is just be who you are. I mentioned that four different times in this thing, but I can't say that enough. Be who you are and surround yourself with people who are not you, you know? So that's really, and I was in a meeting one time and I got choked up because of a certain topic. And I showed my emotions, got choked up, and actually I teared up a little bit, and I showed my emotions in front of my entire management team. And, you know, it's like one of those emotional times. Everybody gets quiet, doesn't know what to say. And it was like that. And after, when we were going around the room and I give everybody an opportunity at the end of every single meeting to have an opportunity to say something or give their viewpoint. And we went around the room and I came to Joey and this gentleman, and he said, you know what? What inspires me is the fact that you are who you are and you're not afraid to show who you are. And he said, that's different about this organization and other organizations, because people try to cover up their feelings or whatever. People understand when people are authentic. And you can't hide it. You think you can fake it? Nobody can fake it. Trust me, I've been around a lot of people in my life, and I don't care who you are. If you don't have noble intentions, people will find out.
Yes.
You know? And so I personally, if you deal with me, I'm big into body language and, you know, and reading people, and it's not always right, but man, when people tell you who they are, you got to listen, and they tell you how they are by what they say and what they do.
Yeah. 100%. How do people reclaim confidence after they've been knocked down?
Well, humility builds it, you know, and I think that, you know, you get, there's a lot of bit conditioning in there, you know, conditioning on when you go through difficulties. I remember when I first started business, one of my fears was is having somebody sue me, you know, for business.
Right.
Because, you know, you lose everything. I put my house online, put everything I owned online. And so that was really a tough one for me, is realizing, that, or dealing with, you know, the fact that when you talk about like, what do you do? It's not just humility, you know, it's more than just that. So, I don't know. That's all I got to say about that.
Now, when you look at where people are today, overwhelmed, uncertain, distracted, trying to stay resilient in a rapidly changing world, what gives you hope?
That my Lord and Savior gave his own one and only son to pay the price for my sins. That's number one. Secondly, and it's not just, it's a lot of people, and obviously we have a priority of people, but it's really about people for me. Yeah. I take pure joy in helping people. And that's my point here, is that if you're hurting or if you're having difficulty, go help somebody else who's also worried about that. And just a brief story. I know we're getting towards the end, but a brief story. After, so long story short, I lost my leg, returned back to active duty, fell through an Iraqi oil platform, busted my leg up pretty good. Was medevaced back to the Bethesda Naval Center, and I had multiple surgeries at Bethesda, and because I basically had a whole bunch of damage to the end of my leg. So. Yeah. I was at Walter Reed and they put me in a room because I had to share a room with somebody. And they put me in a room with a guy that just had returned from Iraq, and he lost both legs, one lower, one upper, and his arm.
Wow.
And I was pissed off. I was upset that I had to go through another series of surgeries, another five surgeries, and I had this infection, and I was just in a really bad mood and was like, well, God, what are you doing to me? You know, why am I in this position? And then being in that room with him changed. I don't know who his name is. I don't know where he went. I don't know anything, but he changed my life because I was able to see his strength through that resilience. Yeah. And through that difficulty, through that adversity. And it just, I get choked up thinking about it, but it's the truth, you know, the helping somebody else is just life changing. People think that, well, you know, it's really being selfish. I hate to say it, but it sounds the opposite of that, but it's being selfish. Yeah. It's looking for hope. It's looking for is this something to do with when you help people? Maybe it's gratitude. I'm not exactly sure, but there's just something there. So what I would tell people to start doing is just go help somebody else. You're having difficulty dealing with something, prescription drug addiction, go get in a group, you know?
Yeah.
And then go help somebody there, because there's always somebody else in the world that's worse off than you.
Right.
So, well, I mean, you know, we've hit the lottery in America. I've been around the world. I built U.S. embassies overseas. And let me tell you, we hit the lottery here. And I don't mean that as being like, you know, or anything like that. But just trust me, I've been to a lot of places. And I tell my kids this all the time, because my kids haven't traveled like I've had to travel. You know? Me and my wife moved 6 times in 12 years. My first, you know, our first part of our marriage. It's going to get tough. Things are going to be difficult, but it's important to overcome those by, once again, intentionality, identifying the issue, and then taking that first step. And that first step doesn't have to be a leap. It can be a shuffle. And so that's
amazing. You know, wow. You know, you've written also some really great books. Can you tell us a little about the books?
So I have actually 4 books. The first one was, as I mentioned, Success Through Adversity. It's actually called Pick Up Your Mat and Walk, because it's based on Mark 2:11, where he, you know, a man that was brought to Jesus that couldn't walk, very similar, obviously. And through his faith, he was healed. So the second book I wrote was A Formula for Success, very small paperback, both of them. I co-authored 2 other books, and one of them, the most recent was a book on construction project management. So more driven, not by this, but by what I do for a living.
I love that. And where can people find your books?
If you type my name in Amazon, it'll come up. All those books will come up. And if you can't, I have a LinkedIn profile. I have an email. Email me. I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction.
I love that. Now, where can people find you?
Well, LinkedIn is the best one, but my email address is sarias@tacege.net. You can email me. I always check my email. I'm not much of a social media guy. I have a LinkedIn account, best thing, you can get on my LinkedIn account. It has all my information. That's the best way to contact me. Or just look up Ace Consulting. That's my company, and you'll see that.
Can you tell everybody a little about your company and the services you provide?
So our company is 4 different sectors. So we do about $30 million in revenue every single year, have 223 people currently. But the 4 sectors are this: pre-construction, doing construction scheduling and more administrative work for construction projects. you know, scheduling, plan services, that kind of thing. Second one is staffing, because, you know, construction, it's more construction related. It's construction management staffing. It's not trades, it's staffing. Third one is training, because I was a professor for years and that kind of falls into what I was doing. And then the last but not least is construction security. And it has to do with a lot of the classified work I've done in the past.
I love that. I love that. For people that are listening to this today, what is one thing that you would really love people to walk away with from this episode that we've covered all these different topics?
And that's a wonderful question. And there's so much to contain in one, but have hope.
If you want.
Have hope. Because there is hope. And our motivation, everything comes from hope.
Yes. That's so true. That's so true. You know, Scott, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. This conversation has been such a powerful reminder that adversity does not have to be the end of your story, that it could be the moment that strips away excuses, reveals character, and forces you to build something stronger than what was ever there before. And you yourself are a proof that setbacks do not disqualify you. They can refine you, focus you, and prepare you for a level of leadership and impact you, you know, and make you realize that, you know, that you could reach levels that you never thought you could reach otherwise. You know, I really thank you for being on the show today. I thank you. You know, you're a true mentor in many people's eyes. You know, everything that you've done, even though you're so humble, you know, you really have shown people that, you know, anything is possible, that you could overcome crisis, that you can, you know, you can face your obstacles and your fears, and you can make your dreams become a reality, you know, with faith and hope. You know, I always say faith, hope, strength, you know, with those characteristics, you know, behind you, you know, anything is possible. And you
chose that,
you know, with your story today. And I thank you so much for being on the show. This has been an honor. And I hope that you'll come back and we can talk some more, because there's so many things that you've done and overcame that I think will inspire others.
Sounds great. Thank you, Stacey.
You're so welcome. You have a great day.
You too.